It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to a violin maker about the difficulty of crafting such delicate instruments. First, on Wednesday of last week, the Federal Reserve raised the short-term interest rate for the first time since 2006. Analysts were worried the move would have a negative impact on markets around the world and the U.S. economy. And now that it's been a couple of days, we called one of our favorite economic analysts to talk about the impact. Chris Farrell joins us now. He's a senior economics contributor for Marketplace and the host of the Unretirement podcast. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me back.
So let's see. Let's start with the term short-term interest rates. What exactly is that and what does it affect?
Okay, so what the Fed has done is raised the target range for the Fed funds rate, which is an overnight lending rate between banks, because banks always need to be sloshing money around. And they've raised it from what has essentially been zero to a target range of a quarter to half a percent. And this is, beginning. You know, you have to use the word tightening in quotes, but it's the beginning of a tightening and a little bit about the reaction of the market. I mean, we've had a lot of volatility, but it's a little bit like Alfred E. Newman, for those listening, you used to remember Mad Magazine, would say, "What? Me worry?" When you look away from all the volatility that's been going on, there hasn't been a huge change in the market.
So when we talk about short-term interest rates, are we talking about car loans, mortgages, that kind of thing?
So the impact on the consumer will really be on where the consumer is going to feel it is on floating rate debt. So if you think about most credit cards are floating rate debt off the prime rate. Prime rate's 3.5%. And in case anyone's wondering, banks are really fast to raise rates. Very slow to lower them. I don't know if you noticed this, but there's a little bit of asymmetry there. So, you might see it if you have like a 10% rate on your credit card, you might see a slightly higher rate on that credit card. If you have a home equity loan that adjusts, you'll see it there. And it will ripple into the auto market. But again, it's not that big an increase. But the expectation is that this is the beginning of a series of increases. And I mentioned, overall, I thought that the market's reaction was contained. There was no major disruption. There was no big credit crunch, all the things that had been feared. But now we're starting into the guessing game. Okay, when's the next time that the Fed is going to raise the rate? What is it going to be looking at? How high will it go? So that will add a measure of uncertainty as we go forward.
Well, there was a long wait for this one since 2006, and it was pretty much the best advertised change in financial business. I mean, did that have anything to do with the smoothness of what we saw? That it was basically marquee news for, weeks, almost months before it happened?
Absolutely. And I think there were a couple things. I mean, if you remember back to last May, when this was sort of first raised by the Fed, and we really had something of a crash in the markets, and there was a lot of concern, and interest rates jumped, and it was way more disruption. And that was sort of a signal to the Fed that it needed to communicate more clearly to Janet Yellen, who's the Fed chairperson. She needed to communicate better with the markets. I also, frankly, I think they got the luck of timing, or perhaps just the wisdom of timing, which is they raised this benchmark interest rate, but offsetting that has been a dramatic fall in the price of oil. Now, there's a concern about does this dramatic fall in the price of oil mean that the global economy is getting weaker, and how weaker will it get? But if you think about it from the point of view of the American consumer, since most of us drive, it's an enormous tax cut to the American consumer. And so even though there are concerns about the longer-term effect of raising rates, right now, the cut from the lower oil prices is probably outweighing the interest rate effect.
We're talking right now with Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace and host of the Unretirement podcast. We're talking about the Fed's decision to increase the short-term interest rate. And Chris, we saw that it was pretty smooth out of the gate, at least at markets here in the United States. What about abroad?
So, there's a lot of concern abroad, and the concerns abroad are really touching on with the emerging markets, because the emerging markets, China, Brazil, Russia, the big emerging markets are having a lot of questions, a lot of problems in countries where a lot of their debt is denominated in dollars. So you live in Hungary, but your interest rate was pegged to the U.S. dollar, the value of U.S. dollar, U.S. interest rates. It could have a spillover effect there. So right now, what weighs on everybody is just how weak is the global economy going to get with all the problems in the emerging market. Offsetting that, it's a sad statement to make, but the U.S. economy is basically like one of the strongest economies in the world, and we all know that's not so great, but it is one of the strongest economies in the world. The employment numbers keep getting better, and so this was really interpreted by market participants as a vote of confidence in the strength in the U.S. economy, which is another reason why I think the Fed went ahead and did it, even though there was a very coherent, strong argument why the Fed shouldn't move, and that strong, coherent argument is that we still have too many unemployed people.
And in terms of the way this all happened and what it could mean for the future, you said all eyes are on, is it going to keep going up? Well, it also seemed as though the Fed was sort of soft-pedaling this as a tentative overture, saying almost we're going to try this, but we're willing to put the brakes on. Is that how you read it?
Yeah, I think what it was, vote of confidence, U.S. economy is stronger. Okay, now let's take a little step back. Let's look at the landscape. Let's see how we do in 2016. You did get the federal budget was passed, and that actually is an enormous help. So we're not going into one of these government shutdowns or sequesters or anything like that. So that actually, from the fiscal side, they're getting some help there. And there is really no inflation. So I think what the Fed is doing is going to watch inflation. It's going to watch employment, how the economic growth unfolds. But that, since they got the fiscal policy at least helping out, my expectation is they're going to continue to move. They're going to be very measured about the move because there's no pressure on the inflation front for them to move quickly.
So if we look at this in a certain way, is this in essence good news? I mean, maybe if you think about the economy as a patient who is sick, on life support, doing much better, released from the hospital, and hence, you know, interest rates go up because the economy's looking pretty good overall, pretty strong globally. Is this good news?
I think this is fine news. Yeah, I think I would actually say this is good news. And the good news is just as you said, the economy is getting stronger. Unemployment, there are more and more people are employed. We're seeing that all the time. We are continuing to grow. And higher interest rates are not a bad thing because you get increased demand for credit. But frankly, as I said at the beginning, this is such a small move that using the word tightening monetary policy is a misnomer. I think what it is, it's a shift. It's a shift from the world of zero interest rates, moving what the Fed has got its fingers crossed to is that it's moving toward a world of higher interest rates. And by the way, the Fed has this upper target range of around 3% is what they're talking about. You know, that would be a goal. It's a long way to 3%, and there's a lot of doubt that they're even going to get close to that.
And looking ahead, 2016, just around the corner, what are your predictions about where this is going to go?
So my predictions for what they're worth is Samuel Goldman has supposedly said, you know, never make predictions about the future, but I will make them. I think the economy will continue to grow. I think we're going to show faster growth, I think, because of the effect of monetary policy is going to accelerate some purchases. I think fiscal policy is no longer a tailwind or a headwind against this economy. And the employment rate continues to improve. So I think 2016 might finally be the breakout year that people have been waiting for. Not rip-roaring, but hopefully this 2% annual rate of growth that we've been stuck in jumps up to a 2.5%, hopefully even 3%.
Great. Well, Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace and the host of the Unretirement podcast. He joined us to talk about the impact of last week's announcement that the Federal Reserve is increasing the short-term interest rate and what that means going forward, also looking ahead there at 2016. Earl Holtzman was already an accomplished woodworker when he decided to try something new. He began making nickel harpas, an early Swedish relative of the violin with keyed notes. And today he's one of few American makers of those instruments, and his whole family has taken it up. Earl and his son Ian share their story and their music.
The nickel harpa is the official folk music instrument of Sweden. It has been played continuously in Sweden, we think, since the 1300s. It is played with a bow. Nickel is Swedish for keyed, so it's a keyed harp. So you have these keys where when you depress the key, you don't have a fingerboard. The keys have a piece of wood that touch the string. And then it also has sympathetic resonation strings.
I personally prefer violin crossed with a hurdy-gurdy, but admittedly not many people know what a hurdy-gurdy is either.
I first saw Nickel Harpa probably in about 1981. My wife and I met folk dancing through Folklore Village, and periodically somebody would show up with a Nickel Harpa at that time, and it was kind of part of the Scandinavian cultural experience.
I started playing the violin when I was about 5, and when I was about 13, I was involved in a playing session where the other musician in the session had a Nickel Harpa, and I got to try it out. And I kind of fell in love with it on the spot because it's similar enough to the violin that I could basically pick it up and start playing it immediately. And I decided I wanted to play one.
Well, Ian had this opportunity to play an instrument, and he decides he wants one, and I did some looking around, and back then, you could get an instrument from Sweden for about $1,500, and I decided that was a little rich for a high school kid, so I did some looking around and discovered that there was a guy by the name of Soren Oker, who had published a set of plans in English on how to build a Nickel Harpa, and was selling kits.
The kit was basically a box containing a bunch of rectangular blocks of wood that were labeled with what part you were supposed to cut them into.
I had not actually made an instrument before I did the Nickel Harpa. I had done woodworking as a serious hobby for about 25 years, and so I just saw that the Nickel Harpa was really just kind of a woodworking project, although a very unusual one. My university career was I was a civil engineer. And I did that for 29 years. And then about time of Ian's senior year in high school, I was involved in a car accident that messed up my back. The Nickel Harpas, it was in part, you know, something to do because of the result of the back injury. There's also the issue that I burned out on the engineering. But for me, the building these instruments, it's an engineering physics experiment in woodworking. And if it works, I can hand it to my son and it makes beautiful music. And I sit back and say, hey, I built that. And wow, it makes this phenomenal music.
Coming from a violin background, this is similar enough that what I already know applies. I also like it because it's just a phenomenally beautiful instrument, both to look at and to play.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. We just heard about that early Swedish relative of the violin, so let's take a moment now to explore the violin and hear about an expert and what goes into crafting such a delicate instrument. Earlier this year, Rob Ferret and I had a conversation with Corinthia Klein, who is a luthier and the owner of Corinthian Violins in Milwaukee.
Corinthia, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, happy to be here.
So when did you first decide, I want to make some violins?
Well, I have a music degree from Ohio State. And I graduated with distinction in music cognition, but I wasn't sure I wanted to specifically perform or teach. And when I was introduced to the idea of making instruments, actually as part of an acoustics project I was doing for a course, I realized that was actually a really good fit for me because it involved music and it involved creating things with my hands, which I missed doing when I started doing music more extensively. So, and I started off at a school that turned out not to be what it should have been. And so in frustration, I wrote to about 40 different builders around the country until I found somebody who was willing to take me on one-on-one. And Brian Derber was in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin at the time, and he was willing to work with me. And he had been a teacher at the Chicago School of Violin Making for a long time and was willing to give me essentially a private version of the Chicago education, which was an amazing opportunity. And I was actually the first graduate of the newly accredited New World School of Violin Making.
How exacting a process is it learning to make a violin? It sounds from the outside incredibly daunting.
Well, it is. I mean, but it's, if you have the right temperament for it, if it's something you want to do, I mean, most of what I do is probably wildly tedious, but, you know, I enjoy it, so I don't find it tedious. But it's, it's very rewarding. I mean, for me, it's a remarkable thing to be able to make an instrument and, you know, to be able to play it when it's done. It's just, it's very rewarding for me.
Well, and that idea we just heard from your instructor, that a part of him will never die. These instruments might outlive him by decades, or if it's like the Stradivarius, for centuries. Do you think that as you're making a violin, that this is something that can endure past your lifespan?
I do, actually. It's a privilege to have a way to contribute to live music after I'm gone. It's one of the few ways I can imagine being able to do that, you know, when other is composition, you know, for to create music for other people to play. But the idea of being able to participate in live performance when I'm no longer here is kind of cool. But it is a very interesting thing. I mean, it's a tradition in the truest sense, in that, you know, as I'm making something in the present, I'm connected to the past, and I'm thinking ahead to the future. I mean, one of the things that makes violins so interesting is that they're designed with repair in mind. So the reason we have instruments from hundreds of years ago that continue to be performed upon today is that they're designed to be fixed. And that's not true for all instruments. I mean, from an engineering standpoint, guitars are sort of designed to explode over about 50 years. They're flat, and they shake themselves to bits. And they're not designed in the same way, whereas violins are assembled with this sense that they could be taken back apart, or things can be repaired, or there's some leeway and some give in there in places that's part of the design. And that's part of why we continue to do it the same way it was done a long time ago, not because we're being quaint, but because it's engineered so well. Those designs still work. I mean, they still look, you know, they're from the Baroque era, so they have the sort of curves and curls on them that are appropriate to that time frame, but a lot of the things on a violin that look decorative are actually functional, and that's why they remain.
Is there a moment when you're making a new instrument that you can tell that this one is going to be one of the good ones?
Well, they've all come out fine, so you know, I it's a tremendous amount of, I've never had one come out where I was disappointed.
All sound the same, or just some of them stand out as really exceptional to you?
Well, every instrument's going to be unique because every piece of wood is unique. But I was trained very well. I mean, Brian is very exacting and specific, and so there is some trying to think what the best word is. There's a little bit of give and take here and there, but you know, he was very specific about where the ranges are. And if I follow my training appropriately, I really can't go too far wrong. As I get better and as I make more instruments over time, I can start to experiment a little more. But for now, just remaining consistent is working well. And once I feel like I've reached a point where I've earned the right to experiment more, I will.
Now, if you played me 10 different violins, they'd probably all sound the same to my untrained ear. But
you'd be surprised.
Well, maybe.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Because I have to say, one of the things that's been interesting for me running my store is, you know, I hear a lot of, you know, students play things, and often their parents are non-musicians. And for instance, one of the things most people don't think about is the bow. Every bow is going to sound different with every instrument. The bow itself makes sound. So often the parents will come in and their child needs a new bow because the teacher says they need a new bow. And the parent is sure they're not going to hear any difference between these bows. And then immediately they hear a difference. And I always tell people, well, but if you couldn't hear the difference, we wouldn't care, you know, because the audience, of course, has to have an opinion and be able to hear the difference between a good quality instrument and a bow and a bad one. And you'd be surprised. I mean, most of the time when people come in looking for a violin, we spend a lot of time talking about what kind of playing they want to do, the type of instrument that's appropriate for chamber music is going to be different from solo playing, is going to be different from fiddle playing, and everybody's style of playing is different. So you know, an aggressive player needs an instrument that might be able to stand up to that, whereas a timid player might need something that can, you know, amplify what they do a little more. And, you know, so no, you would hear a difference. I don't think you would be as
I sit corrected.
Yeah. Corinthia, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Corinthia Klein is a luthier and owner of Corinthian Violins in Milwaukee. Today is the shortest day of the year, meaning it's the longest night of the year. And because of that, it's when organizers mark Homeless Persons Memorial Day, a day when those without shelter will spend the most time of the year outside in the dark at night. Wisconsin ranks in the middle of the pack for homelessness levels nationally, with about 6,000 homeless people, and the number has dropped about 4% since 2010. Wisconsin is one of the coldest states as well, in a region where having a place to go at night can really mean the difference between life and death at this time of year. Today we focus on a success story and what we can learn from it. In 2005, Utah set out to eliminate chronic homelessness in a decade. Exactly 10 years later, Utah has come close to doing just that. They've reduced chronic homelessness by 91%. Here with us today is the man who took the lead there in Utah. Lloyd Pendleton is the former director of Utah's Homeless Task Force. He retired earlier this year. Lloyd, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, what was the homelessness situation like in Utah 10 years ago?
Well, we had about 13,000, almost 14,000 annualized homeless individuals and about 2,000 chronically homeless persons.
And so when you were looking at that challenge, how did the state of Utah compare to other states?
Well, a lot of when you get past California, New York City, Texas, and Florida, Utah compares fairly much with the other states. Like Wisconsin, it's though there's 4 to 6 locations that have like 50 to 60% of the homeless population in the country. So Utah is comparable with another, you know, 40 states, 45 states.
Now, as a conservative, I gather that you used to think homeless people need to get a job. That's what will solve the problem of homelessness, getting that job and then able to provide for housing. Why did you decide against that approach?
Well, that's when I was younger, and I was raised on a ranch, and you learn to work hard on a ranch. And so when I was a teenager in the early 20s, I would see these people that were just laying around, and I'd say, hey, get a job, you lazy bums, and pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And over the years, I got more into this, even though I was in Detroit area at Ford Motor Company, and then came back here to work for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for 26 years. I became aware of the circumstances of the homeless people, individuals, and families, and realized that a high number have had severe abuse, traumatic brain injury, disabling conditions, and that they don't have boots, many of them, to pull themselves up by. So I began to realize, and I morphed in my understanding and approach to reaching out to give them hope. And so, yes, it was a change over several decades in my personal approach and attitude.
So what approach did you ultimately take in Utah?
Well, we learned about the housing first from New York City, Dr. Samson Barris, who developed that about 20 years ago. And we had him come out here and talk to us about it. We had read about it and saw the research. And he outlined what it was like. And we said, okay, that seems to work. And we focused on chronic homelessness, not overall homelessness, because they are the expensive ones to the community, $20,000 to $40,000 to $45,000 a year per person in emergency services. And so we said, all right, we need to build housing because we don't have enough affordable housing, and we didn't have any permanent supportive housing. So we set out on a path to build and bring online a, you know, like 100 to 80 units a year for the next several years. And but in the process of that, we developed a pilot of 17 individuals to just see what the issues were. And as we began to build our first 100 units, we piloted with 17, and I said, we're going to take the most challenging, difficult, chronically homeless people we can find, and we will put them in a scattered site model. We'll go to landlords and work with them in order to house these individuals to prove to us that it worked and to learn what we should do and should not do. And what was very successful, 22 months later, all 17 were still housed. The national average is 85% will be housed after 12 months. So we became real believers that it could happen, and then we took off. Our case managers, our executive directors, our political leaders yes, it can work. It works in Utah like it does in New York City. So we went and built 1,300 units, remodeled hotels and built new units. So we had the units in order to put them into.
I want to hear about those first 22 months, but first, let's get into a little more detail about housing first and that philosophy that this is the baseline for solving homelessness. Why housing first? Why does that work?
Well, when you're focusing on the chronically homeless, you know, individuals within the homeless population, which is about 10%, and yet they're very expensive, and they also have, you know, usually high percentage have mental health issues and substance abuse issues, and so they are not as willing to go into housing that has lots of demands. So the housing first model is, it's a called a harm reduction. You take the person right off the street and you put them into a housing unit, and they can continue to drink, use drugs, just like you can in your house. As long as you don't disturb me as your neighbor, then I'm not. That's okay with me. So, and then you also, then you wrap services around them. You have case management there to work with them to adjust living in a unit and stabilizing, connecting up with the food pantries, getting their Social Security income, veterans pensions, disability insurance, what they're eligible for, mainstream resources. And so you have a case manager help them navigate those systems. And as they develop a relationship with the case manager, then they'll get ready when they realize they have housing, they're safe, and they don't have to fight for a place to stay and be safe. Then they're willing to go into treatments much more amenable to that. Then you can get them into treatment, and after a year or two, then you can get them into employment, getting their income increased through employment. So we found that to be successful. So we have about 10% that will move out successfully every year, move into other housing, reconnect with families, get married, meet a significant other. So it's a low-demand housing which works for this segment of the population that has high needs.
On today, Homeless Persons Memorial Day, we're talking with Lloyd Pendleton, former director of Utah's Homeless Task Force. His task force succeeded at reducing chronic homelessness in the state by 91% in a decade. And Lloyd, you mentioned the cost of this, so this is something that might surprise people. It turns out that it seems to actually be less expensive to put people in housing, to build that housing ultimately, than to have people look for jobs and doing it the other way around. Why is it less expensive?
Well, it because of the emergency services, so your chronically homeless individuals, they call 911, or people call 911 on them because they're inebriated and fallen down or been beaten up by somebody. And so, and the police will see them, they'll send them to jail. And so all those emergency services costs and emergency room visits and EMT runs are very expensive, and that's our most expensive part of our medical system. And they access it a lot. And so we had one fellow who in 2010 went to the emergency room and cost $563,000, just that one person in 1 year. And so that's an outlier, but it was a real person. And so we can put those individuals into housing. We can build a housing unit back then for about $110,000, $120,000 per unit using existing tax credits, preferencing Section 8 vouchers so you can cover the cost of the rent. And then, so once they get housed and you can deal with their medical issues and get them stabilized, then you don't have them in jail as much. They're not going to the emergency room. They go to the medical clinic on a scheduled basis to deal with their health issues. So it will cost the community overall, in most cases, less than it is leaving them on the street.
Now, you mentioned those first 22 months as being sort of a trial balloon. You were going to see how it went. You took 17 of the more difficult homeless people that you could find to try this out and see what challenges arose. What were those first 22 months like?
Well, it was some of them, you know, and I didn't work directly with them, but case managers told me that they moved a lady into one of the units, and the first night she slept on the floor and put her backpack on the bed. The next night she went out and slept by the dumpster two or three nights, got back into the apartment, slept on the floor for a while. Took her some time in order to finally feel that bed was hers and she could sleep in that. And so, and another, when they went to visit the individual, and it was in the winter, they said, "Well, why don't you turn up the heat? It's cold." I said, "How do you turn up the heat?" I said, "Well, you see this thing on the wall? It's called a thermostat, and you just adjust this lever. When you're on the street for 20 years and you've been going to shelters or truly on the street, you don't know those basic living capacities or needs or skills." So our case managers learned a lot, and we weren't doing a pilot to see if we wanted to do this. We're doing a pilot to learn what we needed to do when we put 100 in the first single-site facility we were building. So when we did our pilot, we started building our first 100 units so that we could learn and practice on this first 17. So when we had 100, we would have some experience. So we weren't testing the idea. We're just learning. We had committed to the idea, and so the 17 was a very good learning experience. And one of the things that was quite surprising to me was I was meeting with the case managers at the end of the 22 months, and one of them said, "We used to sit up at the University of Utah, and we'd argue about which theory of case management was the most effective." He said, "Now our theory of case management is anything necessary to keep them housed," which is a pretty major shift. So they work diligently to keep those individuals housed.
So a major shift there you're describing. Was it hard at all to convince people, or did people just sort of see the proof in the pudding as you went along?
They saw the proof in the pudding. We'd read the research, and it sounded great, but sometimes in the West here, when an idea comes from Washington, D.C. or New York City, we're a little suspicious of it because, people think all the good ideas come from the East, and many of them do. But we wanted to see if they work out here, and so it looked great, and we committed to it, and we just said, we'll just practice on this or work with the first 17 or 20, end up being 17, and to learn what we can. But we were committed to the process, and so it became, we became believers. I mean, we from case managers all the way up to politicians, staff people at the state, homeless service providers said, yes, this works, we're committed to it.
We're talking to Lloyd Pendleton right now, former director of Utah's Homeless Task Force. Today is Homeless Persons Memorial Day, and we're looking at Lloyd's work in Utah and his task force's success at reducing chronic homelessness in the state by 91% in a decade. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions about addressing homelessness in your community? Have you been homeless? Would you like to share your experience? And what do you think about this housing first approach? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is Homeless Persons Memorial Day, and we're talking with Lloyd Pendleton, former director of Utah's Homeless Task Force. Under his leadership, Utah cut its chronic homeless rate by 91%. And we welcome your calls on this. What do you think about our guest's housing first approach? You can reach us at 800-642-1234. Would you consider implementing this in your community? And if you've been homeless, you can call in and share your perspective at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Lloyd, population-wise, Utah is a relatively small state. Just about 3 million people. And the states, as you mentioned, with the highest rates are our large population states, New York, Florida, California. Do you think that this housing first model is still something that would work if you put it on a bigger scale?
Oh, yes, very much so. It works. And basically, that's the only thing I think that's going to, solve the problem, because housing is the issue. And you end homelessness by giving them housing. And you put an individual or a family in a housing unit, and you let them stabilize. So the low-demand housing, permanent-supportive housing, is key. So, and I was down in Los Angeles last Friday speaking, and they have a huge number, but they have 10 million people, over 10 million people just in Los Angeles County. So you need, in my view, you break it down into smaller communities, and then you deal with the issues there, but you still bring on housing units, and you get those individuals into housing. That's really the only solution that's viable and is going to work for that population.
What do you think is holding people back? We've got Utah's example out there, cutting chronic homelessness by 91%. So why aren't we seeing more people following suit, more states?
I'm finding more and more are, because in the last 5 months, I've spoken probably a dozen places, taking a look at these ideas. We have many people come here for tours to take a look at it so they can go back and begin to implement. So I'm finding that that is coming up and is becoming a higher priority because there is kind of a more visibility among the homeless population and the drug activity has increased. So it's creating a kind of a heightened awareness. So I think more and more people will be doing this. You have a lot of political want, but you have to move to the political will to repurpose existing funding in order to make it happen. Because we know the solution is permanent supportive housing.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mark on the line in Howards Grove. Mark, hi.
Hi. I just want to give some personal perspective. I've got some close friends who are homeless and trying to start a business. And since the Homeland Security Act now requires any checking account to be attached to a permanent address, the homeless are locked out of trying to get a checking account so they can start a business. And therefore, it's an institutional barrier that creates homelessness and continues to perpetuate the homelessness. The other comment is that this person is discovering that people who actually find out that this person's homeless won't hire the person, and it becomes a almost a lynch mob of businesses that if you are identified as homeless, they will discriminate against you and not hire you.
Mark, thanks a lot. I appreciate your perspective on those couple of points there. And Lloyd, what about some of those structural barriers that Mark was talking about and also the stigma that can come along with homelessness?
Yeah, that is a real challenge. And for, you know, approach we've taken here in the Salt Lake area is that, and across the state, they can use the homeless shelters as an address, and that can be a deterrent. So we have a post office box they can get. And we have a St. Vincent de Paul drop-in center that has where they can get their mail and have a post office box. So there is a means that a case manager can assist them with to get in that kind of an address so they can have that connection. So you need to be creative in working around those institutional barriers. You understand why they have that law in place, but there's a way to work around that. And so we work very collaborative here in Utah to start, how do we deal with this issue and solve the problem to get these people an address and to help them work through and to get into employment. So, yeah, those are real issues, and you know, we feel good about how we've gone about dealing with that.
Now, in Wisconsin in 2015, there were over 500 homeless military veterans, with 3.6% of them living on the streets. What does veteran homelessness look like around the country?
It's about 10 to 12% of the homeless population are veterans, and the Veterans Affairs has done a really good job since 2015 of providing housing vouchers called VASH, Veterans Housing Assistance Vouchers, housing assistance, and also some short-term temporary supportive families. And so a lot of areas have greatly reduced their homeless veterans count because of these resources. And that makes it a little easier to do that because of those added resources. So, and we pretty well have all of our homeless veterans housed. By the end of the month here, we should have all of them housed, and a few will be in shelter. Because I think there's 24 that are still on the street that we've got counted. Now, that doesn't mean it ends as of December 31. It just, there's a system in place that identifies a homeless veteran, and there's a weekly meeting here. We found a new homeless veteran. How do we get them into housing, verify that he's a veteran? So you really want, what we were looking for, our goal, and we're almost there for chronic homeless and veterans, is a system in place that when a person becomes homeless, they're quickly identified and assessed and then provided the appropriate assistance. If it's a family, it's rapid rehousing. If it's a veteran, it's VASH vouchers or SSVF. If it's chronic homeless, it's permanent supportive housing. But they're not going to be homeless very long. That's the system we have in place because there's too many personal choices to say you have eliminated an end in homelessness. Too many drugs, too many alcohol choices that cause people to end up on the street.
How much does it matter how well a state knows its homeless population? I think that I read in Utah that the task force members were on a first-name basis with the chronic homeless in Utah. How much did that matter?
Oh, I think that matters a lot because one of the challenges I've observed across the country is people will say those people, And they're not those people. They're homeless citizens. They're one of us. So we see them here in Utah as one of us. They're our homeless citizens. And they just now happen to have no house. And there happen to be some that got a lot of barriers and that have been without a house for a long time. So getting to know them and developing relationships so that they can trust the outreach workers, the case managers, so that they're willing to come into a housing unit, because a lot of them won't come in because they think there's going to be challenges and problems, barriers. And so they need to trust those case managers to say, all right, come and look at these units, and we'll work with you. So it becomes very important. We're down to a couple hundred, 178 chronically homeless people, and we know them by name. Our outreach workers do. I don't personally. But we're working with them. So, yes, that to me is very important. And we see them as human beings, not as somebody else.
And before we let you go, what do you want a state like Wisconsin to learn, to know about what Utah has done and what it's meant to the state?
It can be done. And you don't have that many homeless people. I mean, your account's like 6,000 for this past year. And so, and your chronic homeless numbers are like in six for the state or like 450, 440. So, and they're very expensive. And so it can be done. But what's needed is somebody that's going to step up and say, I will take the lead. And the governor and key mayors will say, I'm going to support this effort and move down the road and set the priorities in place, realign your resources, and you can get those individuals housed. It can be done.
So it takes a leader.
It takes a champion. It takes several champions, but somebody needs to step up and say, yep, we're going to do it this way. Bring everybody along. It's very collaborative. It's not dictatorial. It's collaborative. And you create a vision and you create hope for the police who have to deal with these people all the time. The police need hope also that they can take those people with whom they deal with on a regular basis and put them into housing because they care for them also. I mean, they see them out there. They see them suffering. So the police need hope. The chronically homeless and homeless people need hope. The homeless veterans need hope. That's what you're bringing. You're bringing hope that they now can stabilize and reconnect with their families and achieve the highest level they're able to personally.
Lloyd, thank you so much for joining us.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
That was Lloyd Pendleton, former director of Utah's Homeless Task Force. It reduced its chronic homeless rate by 91% in a decade in Utah.